It's the weekend, which means it's time for Jill on Money, the show that makes money fun and just happens to answer all your financial questions. Here's your host, Jill Schlesinger.
Welcome to hour number two of Jill on Money. I'm Jill Schlesinger, your hostess, CBS News business analyst, CFP Board senior ambassador, all-around fun gal answering your financial questions. If you would like to get on the air, lots of different ways to get to us. 855-411-JILL. That's our phone number. Our email address, askjill@jillonmoney.com. You can follow us on Twitter at Jill on Money. And you can always check out our podcast, Better Off. Subscribe to it on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, SoundCloud, anywhere else you find your favorite podcast. So today we have an interesting interview. This was one that Marks found like very under the radar, quite interesting. There is an author named Michael Moe, but he's more than an author. Get to that in a second. He's written a book called The Global Silicon Valley Handbook. First of all, it's so pretty. I love it. But it's really fun to hold in your hand. But this guy's got an interesting background because he is founder of a pretty big deal asset management firm. According to the back cover, it says he is regarded as one of the world's preeminent authorities on growth investing. His insights have been routinely solicited by everyone from CNBC to Congress. I'm not sure I'd brag about that latter one, but okay, the former. He's written extensively about investing in the emerging growth equity markets. He's the author of Finding the Next Starbucks, a business bestseller. And this is basically subtitled as The Official Entrepreneur's Guide to the Hottest Startup Scenes from Around the Globe. Michael Moe, welcome to the show. Michael, is Moe short for something? It feels like you've shortened your name because someone came in at Ellis Island and it was like, Moe, blah, 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 blah. Is it Moe it?
No, Moe is Norwegian. And my grandfather, Odd Moe, O-D-D, came from Norway on a boat to Ellis Island.
Yeah.
And you know, basically had a third grade education, ended up in Duluth, Minnesota, made his way down to Minneapolis and had a successful business career. But, you know, it's a kind of a classic American dream story.
And so did you grow up in Minnesota or in North Dakota?
No, Minnesota, but you're right. There's a lot of Moes in Minnesota and North Dakota. It's not quite like Smith, but it's almost that way.
And so tell us a little bit about yourself before you became a superstar asset manager. Like, what's the story of your life, Michael? You got to give us some background. I like stories.
Well, as I said, I grew up in Minneapolis. I have six brothers and sisters, so big family. I played sports growing up, played football at the University of Minnesota. Thought I was going to be a lawyer like my dad, and ended up talking to a friend of my dad's about, he said, have you ever thought about Wall Street? And this was my senior year in college. And, you know, I literally, you know, thought the Federal Reserve was an Indian reservation. I knew nothing about investments or Wall Street. But all I remember him telling me, and this is the mid-'80s, he said you could make, you know, $60,000 your first year. I said, wow, that sounds amazing to me. And so long story short, I sort of stumbled my way into the investment business, got very lucky early in my career as a research analyst, being involved with some very successful small companies that became big companies, and ultimately got from Minneapolis to New York City, where I worked for Lehman Brothers. I ran growth research there, and then I was recruited out to San Francisco 22 years ago to work for an investment boutique called Montgomery Securities, which was one of the firms that basically was involved with all the fast-growing, hot technology companies, and kind of the rest went from there.
And then, okay, and so what's your, like, real job today after Montgomery Securities? Your real job is GSV Asset Management?
GSV is a, asset management is a component of GSV. GSV is a modern merchant bank. It's a merchant bank that we advise and we invest. It's modern, that we focus on emerging growth industries, and that we have created a constellation of businesses that support our activity, or our primary focus of identifying and investing in what I call the stars of tomorrow, which are the fastest growing, most innovative companies in the world.
Can I ask a dumb question?
Yeah. No, sure.
You're like you're obviously some smart, successful dude, right? And I get that. So what? Why do you want to write a book? Isn't it a pain in the neck to write a book? I'm finding that. It's killing me. So why go through this agony?
You know, it's I wrote a – first of all, as I mentioned, I was a research analyst. And so part of being a research analyst is you write a lot. It sort of becomes a habit.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually wrote a weekly piece for over 20 years, which is like jogging. So it's easier just to keep on jogging than to stop.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote my first book 10 years ago called Finding the Next Starbucks. So I happened to be the first person to write research on Starbucks coffee when it went public in 1992. And, you know, I kind of forgot how painful it was because I write all the time, but I forgot how painful it was to have a book published. And so when I had the idea for the Global Silicon Valley Handbook, it's kind of like being an entrepreneur. If you ever, you know, you have it's really important to kind of forget how painful it is to launch a company, just like it's important to forget how painful it is to get a book published.
Right. My sister said that's how you end up having more than one child. You forget how painful it was going through it.
I think that's a good analogy. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit, just before we go to the break, we hear this term about unicorns. How do you define a unicorn?
Well, and actually, I think the standard definition has become a private VC-backed company that has a market value over $1 billion. And so why unicorn became such an interesting term is historically, private VC venture-backed companies, you know, with $1 billion in value either went public way before they got to $1 billion or got sold. And the new phenomena that's taken place over the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years is these private companies are staying private much longer. And because the internet has basically created digital tracks connecting to 3.1 billion people and 2.6 billion smartphones, an entrepreneur, a startup, can reach tens of millions of people at breathtaking speed. So the opportunity to create enormous value fast is unprecedented. So
yeah.
I think, a big part of the backdrop behind the unicorns.
Early in the book, you've got this wild chart that I just focused on and folded down. If you were here, you would see that I have little dog ears on your book.
Oh, great.
And I put like my big pink pen on this one. In the year 2000, number of unicorns, 1. In 2015, the number of unicorns, 133. That is kind of amazing. So when we come back with author and investor and great growth mindset guy all around, Michael Moe, I want to talk a little bit about why these companies are staying private longer and how young entrepreneurs and old entrepreneurs can feel like they can break in. And I think that's the beauty of the book, is that sort of shows you no matter where you are, you can find a little bit of Silicon Valley all over the world. You're listening to Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, 855-411-JILL. The email address, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
Doesn't matter if you're 25 or 65, Jill Schlesinger is here to help you. Back to Jill on Money.
You're back with Jill on Money, and we are delighted to have a guest this hour, Michael Moe, who is a recovering research analyst. Okay, he's not recovering, but he was a research analyst. He did some specializing in the technology universe. And he now works at GSV, which he called a modern merchant bank, which is kind of cool. He's written a book called The Global Silicon Valley Handbook, the official entrepreneur's guide to the hottest startup scenes from around the globe. And before we went to the break, Michael, we were talking about this crazy chart you have about unicorns, which you say are private venture capital backed companies with valuations of more than $1 billion. Why are more, why 133, I'm sure there's more even today after since you've published this, but why are companies staying private longer in this day and age?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, after the internet bubble burst in 2000, you had a number of different changes that took place, some regulatory, some just marketplace, that created less incentive for companies to go public. One was a bill called Sarbanes-Oxley, which put a lot of different burdens on companies in terms of the reporting and the ways that they had to present their financial statements and so forth, which cost millions of dollars. You also had, from the investment banks that historically took these companies public, you had less incentive in terms of trading commissions and ways to pay for the team that was involved with taking companies public and supporting them in the trading markets. And so a bunch of different factors all kind of contributed to the fact that it just wasn't as much the brass ring for a public company, for a CEO of a private company to want to be public.
Yeah, just, I mean, and to some extent, the people who are investing, the backers, the venture capital people, and the private equity people, unless they're banging the table, begging you to go public, then you don't necessarily have to. And it's easier, right, to be outside of that.
Yes. The one other factor that has contributed to companies being able to stay private longer is the fact that there is more capital support for companies as they go through their private company life cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's not necessarily the demands to go public as quickly. That said, I think another key issue is the fact that the public investors, after the dot-com bubble burst and, literally $7 trillion was lost, public investors were much more reluctant to put capital into earlier stage businesses.
Mm.
And so they demanded more maturity, more of a track record. It's kind of like once you put your hand on a stove and burn it once, it's a long time before you put your hand near a stove again.
So in your book, The Global Silicon Valley Handbook, you outline different cities, the cool things that are happening there, the people who are important, the places to meet. I was also struck by the end of the book where you have this list of what you call, I guess, the Pioneer 250. And these are small companies that become big. So if you're looking for what you believe are these really smart companies that are, poised to grow, what is it that puts them in the position to become the next unicorns in this universe?
Well, the fundamental factors is what I call the four Ps. And it's these four Ps that are embedded in every great small company that became a big company that I've ever seen or been involved with. The first P is people. There's no shortage of interesting ideas, but it's always the management team and their ability to execute against an opportunity that is the most important factor. A lot of these companies don't have long histories. Even the management teams often are quite young, but there's a track record with them. You have to kind of assess what their ability is and are they going to be able to deliver on what their idea is. The second P is product. Here, you're looking for a company that truly does something that leads an area, something that's a one-of-a-kind business, something that makes it special, different, or great, has a claim to fame. What you see in technology overall, and the internet specifically, there's a disproportionate gain to the leader in a category. So you really want to find businesses that have the opportunity to be the leader at what they do. The third P is potential. Here you're looking for big markets. The market might not even exist today, but you can see how different factors are contributing to a market that can be very large. And the fourth P is predictability, and this is really the business model. And obviously, you're talking about young businesses, so that's less predictable. But you're looking for factors like, do they have reoccurring revenue? What are the signposts on the highway that indicate that they're on the right track and so forth? So it's really those four Ps that we're looking at first and foremost. But we're also thematic investors. We're looking at trends that are going on in the economy where you have strong tailwinds that are blowing hard, that provide these opportunities to go from idea to being large fast.
How important is the founder in all of this? And I'm just thinking, we're talking to you. There's been a lot of bad press about Uber, and obviously it's, you know, massive unicorn, but the founder or the guy who's running it now, Travis Kalanick, seems to be like a loose cannon. And it doesn't appear to be that there's a grown-up sticking around there. So how do you balance, you know, an aggressive young entrepreneur with vision and all that with this idea that, like, the kid is a little out of control?
Yeah. Well, we're investor left, so
So you hate them. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, no, I wouldn't say it like that. But any event. No, listen, the founder sets the tone for everything. And you know, it's when we talk about the four P's and people being the most important ingredient, it's really the founder that is the chef of that ingredient, right? And even when the founder doesn't remain a CEO, what we found is having the founder be, you know, founder is the heart and soul of the business. So good values are created by the founder, bad values are created by the founder, high expectations are created by the founder, you know, cutting corners is created by the founder. And so the founders, the founder is the start of it all, and so that is a crucial thing, and you know, a lot of these founders are quite young, and so you really it's both art science to determine what the not only the capabilities are, but what are the values and what are the things that will allow the company to not only survive but thrive during their corporate evolution.
So in the couple of minutes that we have left, I just want to have you give some pointers to young entrepreneurs who are going to talk to either a VC or someone as old as I, and let me tell you something, I'm old, about some do's and don'ts that should be important as they start talking about putting this idea and this business into terms that older people can understand.
You know, in the Global Silicon Valley Handbook, we actually provide instructions to an entrepreneur and key things to do and don't. But I'd say the first piece that is the most important piece is just to get an audience with a venture capitalist. You know, one of the key things you need to do is to get a strong reference, you know, into that venture capitalist, because a typical VC was getting 500 or more emails a day with different ideas being thrown across the email. And so unless you have somebody that says, hey, this person's really, you know, a sharp person, you should pay attention to them, I think the likelihood of your email being responded to is as likely as getting the kind of one of those dear sir or madam emails from Nigeria.
I have to say that one of the most fun parts of this book is a little bit of the how to dress, what to say, some really terrific tips for each city and who you need to be following. If you are a budding entrepreneur or you've got one who's actually maybe graduating from college, go out and check out the Global Silicon Valley Handbook, the official entrepreneur's guide to the hottest startup scenes from around the globe. You're listening to Jill on Money. When we return, more of your questions. Thanks again to Michael Moe and the Global Silicon Valley team. We'll be right back.
Have a question? Call anytime, 24/7. 855-411 Jill. Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger.
You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. All right. Getting down to it, by the way, a few days before tax day. And we got a question from Aaron about tax deductions. Aaron has a side hustle on the weekends. He's a brewery tour guide at multiple breweries in the city. Come on. That is awesome. And anyway, he says it's a fun gig. He's got extra cash. And he said he drinks a lot of beer. Could I potentially deduct my beer expenses on my taxes? I think that's aggressive. I think that you probably can figure out a way to justify it. But he only has $3,000 a year in money that comes from that extra cash, that side hustle. And usually your business expenses have to be more than 2% of your adjusted gross income. And I don't think it's just that side hustle income. It's all of your income to be able to actually deduct it. But you can double check. But here's my bigger issue. I simply think that's a bad idea. I think it's like a very, I feel like you got $3,000. If anything, instead of deducting your expenses associated with, go make a retirement plan contribution. That would be so much better. If you can, I'd maybe just have like a little Roth account. Try that. Anyway, I love the question. And I like the desire to get that going. Okay. Let's just see here. Hold on a second. This is, okay, so this is a guy who is interesting because he was listening to another podcast. He also listens to our podcast. If you're not listening to our podcast, you should, better off. But he said he was interested because there's some conversation around robo-advisors. And he said the conversation I heard had a somewhat negative leaning. One of the guys on the other podcast believes that we'll see a reckoning of robo-advising when the next big bear market and market downturn occurs, maybe another 30%. And he said that, you know, this is when we're going to find out whether ordinary people can just stick to their game plan or whether they actually need advice. And so I think this is interesting because we don't know, because many of these robos were created after the financial crisis. What we really want to understand is whether ordinary people will still just be guided by their emotions or not, or will it be that some of these people have really bought into this notion that I've put my money into a robo, I'm leaving it alone regardless of what the market does. We don't know. We don't know. I tend to believe that most people will want to, I think, trump their decision to put their money in a robo, and they will want financial advice, and they probably will make bad decisions, but that remains to be seen. It's also why many of the robos are introducing financial advice as part of the process. And that makes a lot of sense to me. That really does. I think there'll be other questions that are asked about what happens with robos in a down market, like what happens to the assets under management, you know? So, that, again, time will tell. All right, another question. Wait a second, are we good? How's my time? Okay, good. Okay, here's something that someone was asking about. Okay, so I was on CBS this morning about home ownership, and I had, I guess that on the segment, who can remember, it's like a long time ago, that I had said that baby boomers are staying in their homes longer than usual. And here's someone who just said that they've got, he's basically starting a service. I'm sorry, she started a service to really help people redesign their homes to fit with their desire to stay in them longer. Yeah, it's a whole cottage industry, and it's kind of interesting. But the reality is, I think that for many people, one of the big reasons they're not moving is that they may not have as much equity in their home as they thought they would, or the idea of moving to someplace new and great and wonderful doesn't actually save you that much money. So maybe spend the money you have and try to just revamp your own home. I like that idea. Okay. Let me see. Oh my God, I got a lot of emails here, man. All right. Well, I'm not doing that one. Hold on a second. Oh, here's our favorite. Here's our favorite one, Matt, who he's one. How can a minor get started with a brokerage account in terms of ownership? So I think if you have a few hundred dollars a month with a part-time job, I might just have the kid. I don't want to put it. How do you feel, Mark? If you're like a teenager and you're making a few hundred dollars, I just cannot see putting that money in a Roth IRA. I can't. Like, it, because I feel like it's ridiculous to torture a kid like that. Why not do this? How about this? Your teenage son makes a few hundred dollars a month. He's got a part-time job, and he's foolish to keep it in a savings account. How do you get started with a brokerage account? Why don't you have the kid put half of it in like a fun money account so he can spend it, and put the other half in your 529 plan so he's got a little money in your 529 plan for college? How about that? I don't know. I find that the idea of like making a teenager put money, I know it's better for them. But I think you got to split it halvesies. If he wants to put it in a retirement account, then sure, go open a Roth. Ugh. Can you imagine? I'd be so bummed if that were my, if that were like my parents are like, you're six. You know why I saved money when I was 16 years old? So I could spend money. I think it's better, frankly, in my mind, that whatever money the kid makes, just say, okay, great, that's money you make. It's money that I don't have to pay for some of the crap you want. I think that's a better way to do it. But I'm not a parent. Parents, write in and tell us. 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. AskJill at JillOnMoney.com. We'll be right back.
From rookie investors to savvy veterans, Jill Schlesinger is here to help you. Call now, 855-411-JILL, or email askjill at jillonmoney.com.
You're back with Jill on Money. This is the program that takes the mystery out of your financial life. I'm Jill Schlesinger. Mark is running the show from behind the glass, the man behind the glass. I'd love a stand-up desk in the studio. Yeah, he's like, yeah, he never sits. Let me see what it feels like to, but then I can't look down at my computer. I don't know. I got a lot of problems with that right now, but I'm going to have to take a little stretch. Oh, I'm starving. Oh, killer. No, he asked me if I wanted a banana. Dude, I cannot be carbing up at this moment. All right. Corey, if you've got a financial question, before I get to Corey's question, give us a holler. 855-411-JILL. 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. AskJill at JillOnMoney.com. Hey, do you need a financial advisor? Every single one of you who asks me about this, you say, hey, I need a financial advisor. What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? You know what you do? First of all, you can go onto my website. So maybe you should just bookmark the website. Because it's going to just keep getting better and better. I'm thinking I might need a new headshot, though, Mark. What do you think? We need a lot of new stuff. Mark is taking over running my website because I can't do anything. But anyway, on the JillOnMoney.com website, top right, CFP board, click on it, okay? Click on the CFP board. Why? Because it will help you find a CFP professional today. Today. And so that's why I have a link there. And don't forget, I am a certified financial planner and I'm now the CFP board senior ambassador, meaning I just want to tell you, you got to use it. You got to use it. So that's one thing on the website. Another thing on the website is that you can catch up with old shows. So just click on the radio tab and you can do that. So go ahead, head over to JillOnMoney.com. Okay. Now, Corey writes, wants to know, what are my thoughts on buying a rental property in a growing area instead of stock investing? That is, if I had to commit all expendable cash to one or the other. I'm a wimp. I don't know a ton about running a rental property, so I would tend to want to be a making sure that I have more liquid investments before I went into rental property. So for me, I would basically say, do you have all of your big three covered? Have you paid down your consumer debt? Do you have your cash, you know, 6 to 12 months in the bank? Are you maxing out your retirement account? If so, and you've got surplus money, then maybe what I would say is that, you know, sure, you could start creating a game plan to be investing in rental property, but I wouldn't pick rent. Look, again, it's personal preference. I would not choose rental property myself because, A, I tend to shy away from illiquid investments, even if good ones. And B, I don't want to have to bother with that as opposed to just having a non-retirement slush fund, which is so easy for me. So that's, you know, again, personal preference. Corey also wants to know thoughts on 100% allocation into low-cost target retirement funds for Roth 401k and Roth IRA for the entire time until retirement. Hey, I mean, look, target date funds are fine as long as they're low cost. You mentioned they are. I was just reading this great article, actually, about T. Rowe Price and their target date funds and that they've really revolutionize that business. Generally speaking, when you think about a target date fund, the reason why it's better to be 100% is that the point of being in that fund is that you're letting the manager do the work of the allocation for you. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's fine. I think that what happens is that as you get more money in the account, you may want to actually manage the money with just individual stock index funds, a stock, you know, you might say, hey, I want to have a small company fund, a large company fund, an international fund. You may want to do it yourself. Maybe you don't. But either the, you know, target date funds or robo-advisors, sort of a similar theory, which is it's based on what your objectives are long term and what your risk tolerance is. And target date funds, you just have to be careful because sometimes they have more risk. However, this leads me to your third question, Corey, which is, how often should I readjust stock allocation? I'm 22, 100% in stocks. How often should I reduce that stock allocation over time if I invest in a system that does not automatically rebalance? I'm into rebalancing. I do it quarterly, but you know, at age 22, and depending on how much money you have, I might just do it twice a year. If you're 100% in stocks, I mean, that's more risk than I would ever take, even if you're 22, but that's me. I'm a wimp. So for me, I would be, you know, maybe I'd be 80-20. And then if you were thinking about reallocation over time, you know, I would just, because if you're 100% stocks, I'm not sure what you're reallocating unless you have different types of stocks in there. And certainly if you're in a target date fund, you don't need to do that. But if you are in, if you are in different asset classes, I guess I would do it a couple times a year and that's it and try to automate it as much as possible. By the way, Corey wanted to also let us know that he left us a 5-star review for our podcast. And if you haven't checked out our podcast, it's called Better Off. And you can get it on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, SoundCloud, anywhere else you find your favorite podcasts. You, however, right now are listening to Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back. You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we want to hear from you. 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. askjill@jillonmoney.com. Justina writes that she pays $24,000 a year for childcare. Oof. I guess that's not even that much, but it seems like a lot for someone who doesn't have a child. Let me add up how much I pay for doggy daycare. Well, maybe it's all right. Anyway, Justina contributed $5,000 to a flexible spending account. She wants to know, can she claim a $1,000 deduction for childcare on top of the FSA? I wonder if you're using the right term, because I don't know how much money you make, but you may be able to take a credit, not a deduction. So I'm sorry that this is going to be like an annoying. This is when I would have been happy to talk to you. It might have been better. But the reality is that, you know, there are deductions and there are credits, right? And what you need to really understand is that the credits are more valuable than the deductions. And one of the things that you can really be thinking about is that if possible, if you could somehow claim a credit, you're going to be in better shape. And there is actually a tax credit, okay, that's called there's a child tax credit that's worth up to $1,000 for each qualifying child who's under the age of 17, but it phases out for higher earners, and I don't know how much money you make. And then there's also a child and dependent care credit that's available if you pay someone to care for a dependent under 13 so you can work or look for a job. And that one is worth up to $6,000. So what I'm hopeful is that you are able to check this out. And if you've honestly, if you've already filed, I would really be hopeful. Hopefully you can check it out and maybe even like go back and figure out if you need to get the IRS back on the case so that you can claim these credits. So good luck, Justina. Thanks for writing. And thanks for listening. It's been a great show. Good luck with your taxes, procrastinators. It's going to stink for the next couple of days. 855-411-JILL is our number. Send us an email. AskJill@JillOnMoney.com. And always thank Mark for being such a great producer. All right. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.